This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 16, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The US continues its push for a non-elected Iraqi council to take control of Iraq by July, while Paul Bremer says Monday he will ask the United Nations to participate. The World Social Forum kicks off in India. And after a 30-year battle, a victory for Hmong refugees. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Bush has taken an extraordinary step today and named Charles Pickering Sr. to the Federal Appeals Court as a congressional recess appointment. Senate Democrats cited Pickering as one of a handful of judges too right-wing to appoint to the court. Their objections led to a 40-hour standoff last year. In 1959, Pickering wrote an opinion later adopted by the Mississippi legislature in support of criminalizing interracial marriage. More recently, in 1993, he criticized the one-person, one-vote principle. And in 1994, Pickering handed down a light sentence to a man charged by federal authorities for burning a cross on an interracial couple's front lawn. The NAACP charges Judge Pickering has a record of obstructing civil rights for African Americans in Mississippi. Done infrequently and always controversial, the recess appointment will stand for 1 year unless the Senate acts on the stalled nomination. A Seattle man is suing the U.S. government over his $10,000 Treasury fine for violating U.S. sanctions on Iraq. His fine was for delivering humanitarian aid to the country. Martha Baskin reports from Seattle.
Yesterday, a retired engineer from Seattle filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government. Bert Sachs is suing the Office of Foreign Assets Control after being fined $10,000 for a humanitarian aid mission to Iraq. Sachs made 9 such trips. In 1997, during the height of U.S.-led economic sanctions against Iraq, Sachs traveled to Basra with antibiotics and other medical supplies.
I went to the second largest city, Basra, which is at the end of all the waterways in Iraq. And you go there and you see the mothers with their little children who are a couple months old, maybe a couple years old, and you can see some of them are clearly going to die. And you know the reason they're going to die is the water is bad. And then you come back and you read the stories by the Pentagon planners that we deliberately destroyed their infrastructure, their electrical plants, in the Gulf War in 1991. And you realize that you have an obligation to do everything you can to try and help those children, those babies, who are dying as a consequence of the sanctions and the bombing.
Sachs has no intention of paying the fine. When the news hit the front pages in Seattle, a lawyer from a downtown business firm, Garvey Schubert & Bear, sent him a check for his work in Iraq. Later, the firm asked if they could represent him free of charge in challenging the government. The lawsuit alleges that the government overstepped its authority, violated the U.S. Constitution, and flouted international law when it penalized him for humanitarian work. The complaint will be served on federal officials next week. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
World-famous acrobatic troupe Cirque du Soleil admits firing a performer because he has HIV. Now a third California municipality follows Los Angeles and San Francisco in their protests at the performances. More from Kelly Ramirez.
Matthew Cusick, who told the troupe's doctor he had HIV, passed his employment physical. Cusick was fired shortly before his first performance after training with the troupe for several months. The troupe told the San Francisco Human Rights Commission it would not allow HIV-positive people to work with other performers. The Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund has filed a federal discrimination lawsuit on Cusick's behalf. Protesters plan informational pickets throughout Cirque du Soleil's 30-day stay in Costa Mesa. There will be a demonstration on January 22nd. Protests are also planned for tour stops in Atlanta and New York. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
Sri Lanka is heading for another political and constitutional crisis that is further stalling the peace process and frustrating factions within the Tamil Tigers. Poniya Manakavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
President Chandrika Kumaratunga disclosed Tuesday a second secret swearing-in ceremony was held after the last presidential elections. She declared during a state television interview that she could stay on until 2006, a year later than she was expected to end her term in office. The swearing-in was held after surviving a Tamil guerrilla suicidal attack on her life, and she attempted to convince the people that she was safe, the president explained in her interview. The Prime Minister is in a head-on clash with Kumaratunga, who sacked three ministers and took over key ministries including defense on November 4th last year. Meanwhile, Tamil Tiger peace negotiator Anton Balasingham has promised Norwegian peace brokers in Oslo Wednesday the Liberation Tigers will honor a ceasefire with the Sri Lankan government despite a worsening power struggle between the government leaders that has blocked the peace efforts. I am Ponnaiya Manikavasagam for Free Speech Radio News from Vavuniya.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The chief U.S. administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, was in Washington today, where it was announced that Monday he and the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council will go before the UN and appeal for greater United Nations involvement in Iraq. Specifically, Bush administration officials say Bremer will ask for UN involvement in the process of handing sovereignty back to the Iraqi people. Current U.S. plans to appoint an interim government via a caucus system have been criticized as undemocratic by many in Baghdad. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan this morning told reporters that the election process would follow the November 15 agreement between the U.S. and the Iraqi Governing Council. Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, outlines the November 15 agreement.
It is not an agreement that actually represents any kind of broader consensus within Iraq. It calls for a very complicated system of establishing an interim government without elections, which essentially involves setting up caucuses in each of the 18 regions of Iraq where everybody participating at one level or another would be vetted and approved by the United States. So it's designed to ensure that a pro-American interim government, very much like the current governing council, is put in place in Iraq.
At this morning's press conference, McClellan said that much of what is needed for direct elections to be held in Iraq is simply not in place. Chris Toingsing, editor of the Middle East Report, disagrees.
What he's referring to precisely is the absence of a census, a pan-Iraqi census in many, many years that would determine who is eligible to be on the voter rolls. And what Grand Ayatollah Sistani and other Iraqis have said is that the registers that were compiled by the Iraqi government and then used by the United Nations to administer the oil for food program throughout the 1990s, those registers could serve as makeshift voter rolls. And so Iraqis do not see a technical or practical obstacle to direct election.
Meanwhile, sources within the Bush administration told the New York Times that they are considering reversing the policy of not offering reconstruction contracts to countries that oppose the war, such as France, Germany, and Russia. Phyllis Bennis says reversing the decision is convenient timing for the Bush administration.
This announcement emerged just before the meeting that is set in a couple of days at the United Nations between Kofi Annan, the U.S. Occupation Authority head, Paul Bremer, and the head of the Iraqi Governing Council, this month's president, Adnan Pachaki. In that context, there is a great deal of riding on the decision of the United Nations whether or not to go back into Iraq under the terms of the U.S. occupation. I think the U.S. is hoping that if they open up the contracts and allow their opponents on the war, such as France, Germany, and Russia, to bid on those contracts, they may be willing to vote in the Security Council and to push the Secretary General to send the UN back into Iraq without any real authority, but to give a political cover to the U.S. occupation.
And today, France's Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin said it was too early to discuss boosting NATO's role in Iraq, but in what is being described as a sign of warming relations with Washington, de Villepin left the door open to sending troops there once a sovereign government is established. In Iraq, tens of thousands of Iraqis, majority Shia Muslim, took to the streets of Basra again today. They were demonstrating against the U.S. plan to put an unelected, temporary Iraqi government in power by July 1st. The crowd, estimated by British soldiers at 30,000, marched through Basra chanting, "No, no, USA, yes, yes, elections." Independent Labour analyst David Bacon has just returned from Iraq.
The occupation authority is trying to stage manage the appearance of the transfer of power from the occupation, from the U.S., from the military, to a civilian Iraqi government. And they're doing this by trying to kind of wire the governing council to approve some transfer program that will not be based on popular elections and in which the U.S. will have a big voice. So their manipulations are really basically behind the scenes, and what's out in front, of course, are the soldiers and the troops and the announcements in the newspapers about privatization and the dictates that come from the occupation authority.
The fourth annual World Social Forum kicked off today in the Indian city of Mumbai. FSRN correspondent Binu Alex is there.
Debating imperialism is like debating the pros and cons of rape.
Writer and activist Arundhati Roy told it all. But the World Social Forum will be discussing, among other things, imperialism.
Last January, thousands of us from across the world gathered in Brazil, in Porto Alegre, and we reiterated that another world is possible. But a few thousand miles north of us, George Bush and his men were meeting in the White House in Washington, and they were thinking the same thing. They too thought another world is possible.
A pun, but reality. Today, the 4th World Social Forum kicked off with tens of thousands of people from across the globe. They pledge that another world is certainly possible. From indigenous people's rights for their livelihood to the oppressed people's call for self-dignity, everything is covered in the forum. The Western Express Highway in Mumbai, where the event is organized, got clogged by the time it started. The activists got into the mode of celebrating that another world is possible. Dr. Mustafa Baghouti is from Palestine and comes with great hopes. He dreams to establish a democratic Palestinian civil society.
Every person that is in support of human justice anywhere in the world must be with the Palestinian people at this very moment. And we are here to say that time has come to stop this injustice.
With the threat of war looming large on many nations, Nobel laureates like Shirin Ebadi makes her views clear.
Humans who are suffering from war crimes have no dignity left. They have no future. Instead, we should work for peace. And that is why we are all here, to make it possible.
Perhaps the first step towards this can be exemplified from the peace initiatives between India and Pakistan. The known group is from Pakistan, but their performances are more known in India. The delegation from Pakistan has accompanied them. But can the countless number of debates bring about a change? Again, Mustafa Baghouti.
Maybe the World Social Forum has become the second superpower in the world. And I say it's a better superpower because it does not get its power from weapons or nuclear arms, money, and from control of resources. It gets its power from you, from the people, and this is a power that can never, never be overcome.
Father Sajid Prakash is a human rights activist. He believes the message of peace through social justice has already reached the internet audience.
By people coming together, it creates that kind of public awareness which we all need to tell the others that what is happening should not happen. Even if governments are not coming in, directors of the multinationals are not coming in, I think they are aware through this movement called the World Social Forum that what they are doing doesn't help wider society.
International media, which was present in large numbers at the venue, will perhaps help this spread.
Come on, Alan, let's go!
Mumbai, I'm Pinu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
After a week of heavy media attention surrounding the special summit of the Americas, the industrialized Mexican city of Monterrey is returning to its usual routine. While the presidential visits received close attention in the local media, those protesting the summit's agenda were portrayed as dangerous criminals. Notably absent from the media coverage was what the protesters named, quote, 2 days of collectivity, organized in the same spirit as the World Social Forum. Vladimir Flores files this report from Monterrey.
In addition to street protest against the free trade agenda of the Summit of the Americas, the group Apoyo Mutuo, or Mutual Support, organized what they called 2 days of collectivity, bringing activists together into one space to create common ground and cohesion within the movement. Marta Ojeda, from the Coalition for Justice in the Maquiladoras, explains why she traveled from San Antonio, Texas, to protest.
So we are here in this presidential summit because we are totally opposed to these neoliberal policies. We are against the free trade and militarization policies. And we are in favor of other alternatives when sustainable development for all the people. And we are fighting for dignity. And we want to raise our voices with all these people for like Venezuela, Mexico, Argentina, for all those countries on development, opposing to this global economy that the United States just wants to extend.
Large assemblies came together to discuss strategy and tactics. While puppets had become popular in many protests, the Mexican activists used a slightly different visual tool, piñatas. Papier-mâché representations of U.S. President George W. Bush and Mexican President Vicente Fox were brought to the front lines of the protest, where they were set on fire and bashed with sticks. Protesters said this was a way to play with the corporate media message that they had come to commit violent acts. Lifelong Monterrey resident Marisela Steines discusses the effect of seeing people travel from different Mexican cities and countries to participate in the mobilizations in her city.
It's something that's very important because Monterrey is a city of 4 million inhabitants, but it's not very politically conscious like Mexico City, which is important. But those who are here who are politicized really get into it, and their spirits are really raised with these types of situations that the young people come to support.
Jaime is a student activist from Mexico's Autonomous National University. For him, traveling 15 hours by bus from Mexico City is all a part of building alliances with like-minded individuals throughout the country.
Así, diario es como estamos haciendo, sembrando la resistencia y parar las cumbres. Pensamos que no es con...
This way, we sow the seeds of resistance daily. We don't necessarily think that it's by going to the barricades and demonstrating radically that we're going to stop the summits, that we're going to stop these types of policies from advancing. We think that it's with organization, by strengthening the movement, like we just did, that this is the way we're going to make it happen.
This type of cross-cultural networking was evident in the simple fact that after a large march, anarcho-punks from Mexico City went to a political ska concert held at the Mexican Telephone Workers Union Hall. In collaboration with Shannon Young, I am Vladimir Flores in Monterrey for Free Speech Radio News.
The Department of Homeland Security is about to start color-coding travelers. Under the government's new computer-assisted passenger pre-screening program 2, or CAPS-2, the government will use a computer program designed by Lockheed Martin to sift through public and secret government databases, assigning a color to everyone who wants to fly. Green-coded passengers will be free to fly after passing through regular security. Yellow-coded passengers will be subjected to thorough searches. Meanwhile, red-coded travelers will not be allowed to fly. Passengers won't be able to check their color before flying. All this as the Department of Homeland Security begins fingerprinting and eye scanning most non-European visitors before they're allowed to enter the U.S. From San Francisco International Airport, Aaron Glantz reports.
Guatemalan Dr. Joaquin Barnoya is hardly the portrait of a terrorist. The physician completed two research fellowships at Harvard and currently works for the University of California. Since coming to America 5 years ago, he's returned to his native country many times. But none of those trips prepared him for last week's trip through customs at George Bush International Airport in Houston.
I've seen plenty of movies here in the about the Holocaust, and this is how they were screened. I mean, you would see Jewish people holding their IDs and then going to the concentration camp. That's exactly the same feeling I got. You were just walking there with your passport, making sure your papers were in order, kind of nervous because as much as papers you can have, if the officer behind the window doesn't like you, that's it. You're gonna stay there or be sent back.
After being delayed for hours, being fingerprinted, receiving a retinal scan, and having his bag searched, Joaquin cleared customs. By then, he had missed 3 connecting flights to San Francisco.
If the government is spending all of this time and all of these resources stopping innocent passengers at airports across the country, does this really make us safer, or does it create a false sense of security?
Jayshree Srikantaya is a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union. She represents 2 San Francisco area peace activists who were prevented from flying because their names appeared to be on an FBI no-fly list. The ACLU sued the FBI, demanding they turn over documents showing how many people are placed on such lists. When the FBI eventually turned over some documents after months of waiting, most of the pages were completely blacked out. Srikantaya sees the government's new CAPS II color coding system for travelers as fraught with the same secrecy.
The bottom line is here that innocent passengers are going to find themselves labeled a red or a yellow threat and have no way of knowing why they were labeled that red or yellow color or how they can get that label removed.
But in the arrivals terminal at San Francisco International Airport, few were worried about the new laws. Art is a 46-year-old Filipino-American waiting for his elderly mother-in-law to arrive from Manila. He's not worried about the government's abuse of power, but he does wonder why the new government program for fingerprinting and eye-scanning visitors doesn't apply to most Europeans.
They can just come right through. That doesn't make sense. I mean, it's proven in the past that some terrorists have used that route to come here. So it's like you leave all the doors to your house locked, but you leave the front door open. It makes no sense. You know, you're going to lock the doors to your house for security, lock them all. Why leave any open?
Alleged shoe bomber Richard Reed holds a British passport. Zacharias Moussaoui, the only man arrested in connection with September 11th, holds a French passport. Palestinian-American Mazen Halim says the new measures sound familiar.
I've lived in a different country, in Israel. They have way harsher security, so I think America is just trying to do the same way, but in a different way, you know what I mean? They're trying to keep the security, but not in like a harsh, like where they search you and all that, but they're still scanning you and searching your stuff without kind of you knowing. They're just putting it through a machine and all that, but I don't know. I think it's all right.
The Department of Homeland Security failed to return calls for this story. Multinational arms contractor Lockheed Martin has already been awarded $12.8 million to develop the color coding system. The Center for Public Integrity reports today Democratic candidate for president General Wesley Clark has received close to $1 million from the security company Axion in its bid to win an estimated $1 billion contract to run the system. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in San Francisco.
The Lao American Congressional Policy Conference and the Center for Public Policy Analysis today held a discussion on reports by the UN and Amnesty International on the Lao regime's use of starvation as a weapon against Laotian and Hmong civilians and other opposition groups. And while Hmong immigrants here in the U.S. have for many decades fought for basic rights, just last month the State Department announced that resettlement eligibility would be extended to all Hmong refugees. As Carrie Byron and Kristen Lerstrom report, this news has put into motion the beginning of the end of a 30-year-long struggle for a group of over 14,000 Hmong refugees.
For many of the over 200,000 Hmong Americans across the country, the State Department's mid-December decision meant not only the end of a frustrating struggle, but the promise to see family members old and new. Kai Yang Yang is the former executive director of the Southeast Asian Resource Action Center in Washington, D.C., an advocacy group that has led efforts to offer this group of refugees a home. She says that while many questions remain, the State Department's decision has been received with relief.
This decision was made mainly because there are many Hmong Americans living in this country, and they've been advocating for the resettlement and protection of this population. They've been able to survive mainly because their Hmong American relatives have been sending money back to them to support them in many ways.
In the mid-1970s, Hmong refugees had started fleeing the newly communist Laos. After crossing the Mekong River, the first stop for most was the relative security of Thailand. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees set up two major refugee camps and notified Western countries of the imminent emergency. To deal with overflow, a third, unofficial camp was established on the sacred grounds of Wat Tham Krabak. Mi Mua, a Hmong refugee who immigrated to the United States in 1978, is now a Minnesota state senator.
This last camp that we're talking about is really actually not an established refugee camp, but it is actually a Buddhist temple. And so when these refugees started arriving, I think the abbot opened up the doors to give haven to these refugees that were coming in. And that's why they felt comfortable remaining in that, in the temple grounds up until this point.
This point, however, is nearly 30 years later. The two UN camps were dismantled in 1997, and thousands were permanently resettled in foreign countries. Fearing repatriation to a hostile homeland, however, thousands of others sought the sanctuary of the temple camp. Its temporary grounds became the long-term settlement for up to 30,000 refugees. Due to the camp's unofficial status, no country ever recognized these Hmong as refugees, nor offered aid or asylum. Remaining a people without a homeland for the following three decades, Senator Mua says that the Thai government only tolerated the temple's refugees out of respect for the outspoken abbot. Considered a very holy person in Thailand, when he died 2 years ago, an already poor situation began to more quickly deteriorate. Thus, it was a welcome surprise when, in the week before Christmas, the State Department finally agreed to extend asylum to all those living at the camp deemed eligible. In Minneapolis, within 2 days of the decision, the community had convened a working group to plan resettlement strategies. Chow Lee is the field staff representative for Minnesota Congresswoman Betty McCollum and the co-chair of the Watt Resettlement Working Group. He says that this group of refugees is facing a significantly different resettlement environment than that dealt with by the first wave of Hmong emigrants.
Now I think the focus is going to be on the Hmong community here to address the challenges. You know, what's going to happen is you won't see the kind of generosities of services and support system that existed way back in the 80s and 90s when the first early waves of Hmong refugees arrived here.
In a country worried about an economic downswing, much of the responsibility will fall on the shoulders of the established Hmong community to deal with issues of housing, health care, language, and employment. Despite the inevitable adjustments, Senator Mua looks forward to the refugees finally having the possibility to experience a stable life.
Understand that these individuals have been living in limbo for the last 25-some years. There are individuals who were born in the camp, who've lived in the camp all of their lives, and they've never had an experience of a normal life. For once, we will have a chance to set root and to actually think about life beyond just tomorrow and next week, but to think about life for the next 5, 10, 15 years.
The application process is to begin in February, with the first refugees slated to arrive into the U.S. in early summer. With Kristen Lerstrom from KFAI in Minneapolis, this is Carrie Byron for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Producers are Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Randy Zimmerman. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. Technical producers are Jade Paget-Seekins, Lindsay Benedict, Pauline Bartolone, and Mick Million. FSRN is a worker-run collective. For more information, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.